Had enough of the been there, done that ideas? Tired of too much talk and so little action? Rewind now and welcome to Transformation and Change Radio with Dr. Kathy Obair, where the vision of true equity, inclusion, courage, and purpose meet powerfully. Dr. Kathy delivers with dynamic, engaging conversation and the most authentically brave dialogue on air today. This hit show will challenge you to explore current issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion and deepen your capacity to choose courage to speak up to greater inclusion in everything you do. Fasten your seatbelts and accelerate your effectiveness to become a powerful change agent in your life, community, job, and society. Imagine true equity and inclusion and get the tools to really manifest your vision. No frills, no fluff, just really powerful, good stuff. Transformation and Change Radio starts now.
Welcome back to Transformation and Change Radio. Dr. Becky Martinez and I, Dr. Kathy Obair, are excited to continue our deep dive into how do you design and facilitate workshops on class and classism inside your organization or in community regional organizations. For folks who have been following this, you might remember in the first two, part one and two, we looked at why is it even important? How do you get leaders to even pay attention that we have to talk about dynamics of class and hierarchy within the organization in a similar way we talk about racism or sexism or homophobia? Then we talked about how to create the container, how to really get people reflecting on their own class journey as they're learning some of these terms and concepts that you can do officially and or through some kind of reflecting back on some of the prompts we offered. And if they're like me, I didn't realize I grew up middle class, professional white collar class until really started digging into what it was like for me compared to other folk. We then spent a good time, especially in session part two, where we looked at microaggressions, kind of what are some of the daily dynamics that have many people feeling they don't belong, they're not visible, they're not valued, they're not respected. And then what are the biases underneath them? Having people then look at, so do I speak up? Sharing some of those, why don't I speak up? How can I speak up? And practice, practice, practice. Anything you want to add, Dr. Martinez, of what we've covered so far before I share where we're going?
You know what? I think that the add that I would add is for the last couple of sessions, and then even the sessions before that, really paying attention to language. That's one of the things that I did two class sessions last week, one for a graduate school class and then one for a school of nursing. And just for us to look over a slide that I have around language and how, and we've talked about this, like class can be so coded in language. And so as we think about like the different levels of isms that exist or power, privilege, and oppression, like want folks to think about, huh, so what language do I use? What language do I have assumptions around? What have I learned around class language that I buy into, especially as I lead, right? And what do I need to like slow down or slow our department down to really listen to the language that's used, especially as we talk about this part three?
Because we did a bit about the importance of having a look at the history of classism in your organization, in your industry, systemic class dynamics. And part of that is the language that's in the culture and the climate and the everyday conversation. And that's some of what we'll be able to do today. We'll probably start off talking about vision to try to get people to even begin to imagine what could it look like to have a truly inclusive environment that does not support or perpetuate classism. We'll look at some of those unwritten rules possibly. And then what do you do if you're the one that says something that's off, that uses language that actually reinforces this hierarchy of I'm smarter and better because I have more class privilege and you're not as valuable. And then we'll see where else we go. How does that sound?
Yep, sounds like a good plan.
Well, if we start with vision, I know sometimes we start with that early in a session. What I'm finding, and particularly as I'm doing anti-racism work, is most leaders and middle managers can't envision what it could be different. And so I think that might be one reason we're saying you may want to, you could start there, but you may want to circle back. And so are there ways that you get folks to think about how do you envision an organization where we get rid of classist dynamics, policies, and practices?
Yeah, that one is a hard, like that one's a trick. right? Because it's, I mean, if we go to financial capital, it is like, how do we look at like pay grades and positions and responsibility and, you know, in degrees or experiences or certificates or skills. And like what I do is like, I'm not offering you to be like, have a flat organization. But it is, how are we transparent with our pay, right? From the get-go, from how we advertise and what that means. How do we look at our hiring process? So really dig into the requirements, and be critical of what they are. And there are skills. Like I'm not saying, I mean, I'm somebody who has 3 degrees. so I even have to pay attention to how I've bought in some things. And I have knowledge and skills and competency, in staying in, you know, my space of my sphere of work, that others don't have, and vice versa. And how when we're looking over those job descriptions or that pool, are we keeping our own, like naming our own biases of like past experience or institutions or degrees, or and paying attention to like the hierarchy that we have and the value of importance of those.
So what you're suggesting is one way, almost kind of ground up, what are the ways we do business in the organization? Hiring, promotion, meetings, decision-making, and how are those already classed? Mm-hmm. And then what could be different if we really tried to eliminate that? So that's one way to go at vision, is what is it currently? And then how do we want people to be, feel, what do we want people doing differently? So therefore, how do we change practices? Another way I find, and actually that might be the most useful because it's more tactile and concrete. Sometimes I do ask folks, just imagine, how do you want to be and feel? And I want to give you credit, Dr. Becky Martinez. When you first told me, how do you want people to be? I remember in the Social Justice Training Institute looking at you like, what are you talking about? I knew how to think. I knew finally how to feel and what to do. But to actually be how I want my presence to be, how I want to show up, that language was so different than anything I had been taught. And yet I integrate that language all the time now, but I still get the faces that I used to make to you. And so that could be, what do you want different? So you could start with the broader and then say, now let's look at the different ways we do business, marketing. How could we do that by eliminating kind of a classist approach?
Yeah. When I think of the being, I think about, how do we run meetings? What does that look like? One of the things that I've learned greatly from you and Jamie and the SJTI folks is to get all the things covered, but it doesn't need to be even in an agenda format, right? Like that feels so, that doesn't allow space for folks to be. And it gets so rigid. I even haven't thought about what class and rigidity, like how they interplay with each other. Cause I think about like whiteness and rigidity. And I think that there's a class layer on there. I just haven't, I think, engaged enough to think about really what that means. Meeting structures, like how could those be different? How could those be more equitable through a class lens? How are all voices part of that space? And I know that if the organization is 100 people, that gets to be difficult. And like, what can be the contribution? Or at least how are we very clear on meeting structures and how they, like, how are we, I think this is a great class space to think about. We have assumptions that everybody knows their part in the meeting. And that is not all, that's not the case. I've been working with an organization for like 6 months. And that's one of the things that they've been spinning around is meetings. Like, when can I give input? Am I just supposed to be an observer? Am I supposed to give information or a report? Can I ask questions? And so that feels very hierarchical to me, and very limited knowledge and transparency via how meetings are ran. And so like, let's bust that open and be very clear around, here's the meeting structure. Here are the intentions for these different types of meetings. Here's when we, like, here's the ones that we're just giving information, and here are the ones where we want to engage in, rather than, oh yeah, everybody can show up and attend. Okay, but like, they don't know the intention of that. And so like, meeting and meeting structures and meeting engagement, and let's not assume that people know how and what and why in meetings. Like, that'll bring some clarity that I think is really important across levels.
And if you're doing these trainings in a series, homework could be go observe 3 to 5 meetings and notice by hierarchical level, positional status, which is usually similar, but not always, the degrees people have and any other, who shares, who gets interrupted, who interrupts. So notice some of those dynamics, who can do those roles and tasks, or is it really top down and very rigidly run by the folks with the most class power? And then come back and share, and what were the results and what were the misses and gaps, and then what could be different? And so that could be an activity that gets people very concrete, looking at the current state on a type of business project meetings with a class lens, and then come back and say, when have you ever done it differently? What could be different? And so depending on the folks you all work with, this very kind of concrete grassroots way of doing it could be exactly what's needed. And other folks, depends again who you're working with, you may be working with some visionary type strategic thinkers who can enter in what could be different from the start. And they can imagine, how would life be different? So anything else, Becky? Because if not, I want to talk about how you then begin to talk about the current climate and culture.
Yeah, go ahead. Let's do that.
I only do assessment 0 to 10. That's all I know how to do. Not at all completely. And so once people talk about what could be different and what's our vision, how do we want people to feel included, belong, respected, able to contribute, to get the best ideas, whatever that classless, anti-classist organization looks like. Then the analysis of how close are we, 0 to 10. And whether it's people individually first reflect and then come with some data points, and I don't mean quantitative only, it can be anecdotal stories without names, their own personal experience, but they could say it's like a 4 or 5 and here's why. And they may want to then talk to an accountability partner if you've set up core groups first. You could do a continuum if the group you're working with has enough bravery and authenticity. Mm-hmm. Where do you currently, given what you know and what you've heard, where do you think many people would say we are? I kind of generalized it a bit at the group level in case people aren't ready to personally claim. People could then move into a continuum, turn and talk to a few people, and then have small groups share out. Well, we think it's kind of a 2 or 3. We think it's a 7 or 8 and share. Mm-hmm. And that dialogue about where we are, how far we've come, higher levels, 7, 8, 9, 10s will think, look how far we've come, folks. 0 to 5-ish will say, look how far we need to go. This kind of an activity can help people hear each other about the current climate from their perspectives.
Yeah. And as you're talking, I'm thinking about all of, I think folks who are listening really need to pay attention to all of the work that's able to get to that space.
Part 1 and 2.
Yes, right. And it may be like part 1 3 times and part 2 3 times. Because we're so not practiced and we're scared and we're shamed to like do that continuum, right? Be intentional and be careful. Because I think the setup, like as I hear that, the setup is, I don't know, 3 months to get to, 6 months to get to.
If they're committed,
right? And if it is a part of their practice. And it would be lovely to be in that space and say, I'm a to, and not just from a like a money space, and know that that's where a lot of folks are going to go, mm-hmm. right? Position, money, office space, title. And that's why I say the setup is so important, so that they know it's not just that, right? It is treatment. It is value. It is expectations, and not just expectations of doing your job responsibilities, but expectations of how you dress or how you talk, or if you go to a happy hour or not, and if you're a team player or you're not. So there's so much more to that. Like, so I would want that assessment to be as deep as it could be, so that folks just don't stick in the money range.
So a couple thoughts as I hear you. The fear of authenticity because of the retaliation that is so real, particularly in organizations that aren't very far along in their dismantling classism journey. Using anonymous tools like Padlet, Jamboard, Poll Everywhere. And to your point, it could even be something, several, which could be what are the, where they share not only the number, but some of the data about how we're supposed to look, dress, and act. Where are we? So you can break it down like that. The power to make decisions, to decide. So keep breathing, everyone. We get much more complex in what's needed and possible the more we talk. And know that you can only choose so much in one meeting, one meal, and over 6 months to 12, keeping the focus on dismantling classism could be powerful. And so envisioning what's possible in all the different business type of operations, and then where are we, and then what's do we need to do to shift is part of where we're headed in this.
And I think as folks are doing class-related work or anti-class-related work, I was leading a session a couple of weeks ago, and somebody had talked about, and I was fascinated. I'd never heard this. And I told her I'm borrowing it, is as you're thinking about engaging individually and collectively, she said, you know, this is my paycheck function and this is my passion function. And I was like, oh, and she talked about, so this is what I get paid for. And some of it I like and some of it I don't, but like, this is what I'm passionate about. And she was so appreciative of her supervisor that they've had conversations to be able to also do her passion function and not just her job responsibility function, and not having it be layered where it is then extra or other duties assigned, but really looking about, okay, so what is it that we need you to do? And what is it that you're passionate to do? And not meaning that they can't overlap, but for her, they were distinctly different. And so the listening from her supervisor or the leadership to be like, okay, how can we support you in this position for both of those to be true?
That approach and strategy and way of being is about self-care, community care, rejuvenating, retention. And when I was a manager, it was 30 plus years ago, I had the flexibility to follow my passion. I was high enough in the organization. Nobody questioned what I was doing. If I had an idea of a new conference or a new workshop or a new class I wanted to teach, I could do it. And so my guess is this is another criteria of classism: who gets to follow their passion within their sphere of influence or beyond without being questioned, challenged, retaliation, and who doesn't. That's another indicator of hierarchy, power, class. So good.
Very much so. And she was in development. So she recognized the tension at times. Because her job is to go and get money for this particular unit. And so she's like, that's what I get paid for. And so that tension is eased a little bit. What's the possibility of me also doing things that I'm really passionate about?
And if you're a supervisor, manager, leader listening, it's not an either or.
Right.
In fact, as people are engaged in more systemic, passionate endeavors. They're building relationships. They're seeing more of the climate and culture. They're getting ideas to bring back to their unit. And yet, I think a classist structure teaches us compartmentalize, just do your job, do what you're told, as opposed to seeing the bigger picture. The more we can get folks throughout the organization involved in dismantling classism in their area, as well as task forces that are cross areas, all of that benefits the larger strategic picture. And yet we have to first let go of our vision that people have to be tied to a desk or a phone in order for them to do their job. Talk about classism.
Oof. Yeah, right. And that is, like, the pandemic has thrown that on our heads, of being able to do business differently. And we know that there's some folks that are still really open to going down that path, and there's others that you got to be in the office, and you know, what does that mean? And it's an interesting crossroads that we're at, that a lot of folks are at right now, around what does work look and feel like.
And so that could be another, as we come almost to our halfway point, what's the kind of work climate you work best in, you thrive in? And who gets access to this? And is there a class hierarchical dynamic? And so having the group, because even you said flexibility, a chance to do passion work, chance to balance your lifestyle so that you can be remote, in person, hybrid. There's so many other ways that there's relationship building in addition to task completion. So that's another way to get at what is kind of the vision of an environment where people can do their best work, and we can dismantle these classist oppressive structures. How close are we? And then who gets access, and how can we broaden this so people can all have access?
Yeah. Ooh, that's good. I'm still thinking about that then, and what that means, and what that would bump against in my own socialization and organizationally, what that would bump against. So I'm excited to talk about that when we come back.
And again, it's not an either or, as you said, we're not getting rid of hierarchy. Not everybody has access to everything, but can we do more? Can it be more fair? And can we see this unearned, undeserved, real class privilege that folks in the hierarchical high levels, top leaders, senior leaders, AVPs get, that even managers often don't, much less, quote, people in lower level positions. So we just have a couple minutes left before we break. Anything else coming up?
I think from a culture perspective, one of the things to pay attention to in the conversation is the assumption that these upper leaders or upper management come from a class of origin that is an upper management class of origin, and that is a myth. And so one, people can take on these norms and values, and then sometimes there's a tension or a mismatch between that, and then people leave. And so how do we set cultural norms where there is, we like take that myth out? And maybe that's the engagement in the beginning. And now I know I'm getting too much into the like depths of the, is what folks should do. But I think that that's really important to pay attention to, is that myth.
I love it. And at this point in a workshop, it could be come in thinking about what were the values, the culture you grew up in by class, which of those reflected in the current climate of culture, which of these actually have you had to hide or you've punished if you brought in, and which of those do you think actually would expand us, help us meet our goal? Speaking of meeting our goal, we need to close out this first session. Doctors Becky Martinez and Kathy O'Bear, Center for Transformation and Change Radio, we're excited to come back to continue to look at designing and facilitating kind of the systemic change parts of workshops on classism. We'll be back in a few.
I I am Carissa Atkins, and I help women boss up, get fit, and become unstoppable. And I do this by helping them create healthy habits that support nutrition and exercise and mindset work and stress management and self-care. You get the idea. If that sounds something like you're interested in, you can find me everywhere. Just Google, you know, Carissa Atkins 365 Daily Hustle. It's a global health coaching company. So I'm coaching women all over the world.
You are made for more. I'm Coach Lisa, and I'm here to help you achieve ultimate life satisfaction. Your life matters to the world. Reimagine your future with an individualized life by design approach with my free ebook, The 5 C's of Coaching: Commitment, Clarity, Coachable, Creative, and Change. Find the transformation you're looking for. Go to lisabeltz.com. That's LYSABELTZ.com.
Tune in to the hit show, Us, Critical Conversations on the Challenges of Our Time, with me, Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, on TransformationTalkRadio.com every fourth Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific. Listen while we focus on the intersections of truth and justice as we learn how to coexist, pushing our social transformation to the next level. Become true stewards of the justice that is needed in our world. Learn more at PreventionAgenda.org. That's PreventionAgenda.org.
We are courageously expanding love on my new show, The Elizabeth Cunningham Show, every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Join me and my guests where we talk about relationships, sex, love, and the ways we wish we could be but never thought were possible. Visit ElizabethAnnCunningham.com and subscribe.
Do you feel like love is just taking you for a ride? If you struggle to find yourself in a fulfilling romantic relationship, join me, Love Coach Mariah, in my show, Becoming Secure in Love, From Push and Pull to Peace of Mind, every second and fourth Wednesday at 6 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Discover the joy of being loved as your true, authentic self. Visit LoveCoachMariah.com for more. That's LoveCoachMariah.com.
Welcome back to Center for Transformative Change Radio, Drs. Becky Martinez, Kathy O'Bear. We won't even be done after this segment, but we are finishing up part three of Designing and Facilitating Workshops. I was talking to a colleague the other day, Becky, who was in, I was working in a school district, and she told the story about how in one school, their PTA was more upper middle class, upper class folks. And so they'd raised $600,000 dollars in 1 year to support things that parent and teacher associations do. Mm-hmm. Contrasted that, she said, to within just a mile or so, another neighborhood is school districts and schools often are based on taxes, real estate taxes. That school system had a school, several schools that might have raised 50 to 100,000, and that was a lot. And other schools that were less than 50,000. So imagine the different extracurricular. So the one first school actually paid for teacher assistants and other staff. Mm. And so I sat with how much I don't know and how policies and practices that we've inherited were setting up a very rigid class system that benefits people with cost privilege to continue. And that was just one way, an example of what I don't know. Another, just want to share, Scene on Radio, S-C-E-N-E on Radio, has great stuff around racism. And in some of their podcasts, they deeply into classism. And over the summer, they highlighted some reruns of those. So just reminds me, as the listeners, you're taking this in, just breathe. It's a lot. And we're all on a journey. And what can you be doing now to keep realizing what you don't know as you help others? And so I want to use that to introduce another key skill set as we're looking at dismantling classist organizations is policies and practices. In addition to microaggressions, those interpersonal comments and inactions, what might be on the website, what's in written word, what are the policies, practices, norms, programs, services, how might they have been set up to benefit folks with more class privilege? And do they unconsciously or maybe intentionally create barriers for folks with less access to resources, come in with poor working class current status? So with that, anything you want to add before we kind of talk about specifics of how to teach it?
Well, I love the story. So thank you for sharing that. And yeah, as we look at districts and pay attention to that, I also want to add the layer, because what it prompted me to think about is kids' athletics. And so one of the things that I've paid more attention to is that, like, the parents or the caretakers who can set things up or who can't, or all that other stuff. And, you know, what does equal participation look like to support your child in athletics? And for some, either different sports or organizations or a cross mix, if you, so it's like, oh, you have to do 10 hours or you can pay $50. And so, like, who's like paying the $50 and like, I don't want, like, I'm not going to do the work. And then it gets complicated, right? Of, well, you know, I'm a single parent. And so like 10 hours is a lot of time. And so is $50. But now I have these competing priorities or needs. And that's where class isn't easy. And then who gets to be the in-group, right? So who's the parent that's always showing up? But it's like, and then those parents know that the other parent or the family person has paid money to not show up. So then what's the judgment? What are the dynamics? But it's like, well, I'm a single parent and like, I've got to be able to work, or I've got other kids or other responsibilities and I can't do that. But see, that this is how I think class plays itself out, even with our young folks. That's a policy and a practice, and there's a norm. And so it becomes really sticky. And I want folks to pay attention to, and that's why it's really messy to talk about. Because there is no, like, which is the better option, or what is the less anti-classist option? Because they're it's a challenging decision.
Yeah. And those either or. So what you just shared could be literally, listeners, the scenario that you write up as you're introducing the skill set of how do you identify, then analyze and revise practices, policies, programs, services. So use one that's not in your organization, but that people relate to, because I'll bet 70-80% of the people in workshops can relate to what you just said, Becky. I don't have kids, but I have friends with kids that are in athletics. I like to watch athletics. I've donated to high school teams, so even me would be interested in that one. So you find like three scenarios like that and have people chew on them for a while. Are there any unintended class privilege in this? Would people with different life experiences that are related to class of origin, current class, be negatively impacted by this? What's the impact then on the students, the people playing, the folks that pay money? What access might they get? Will they get the coach's ear? Will their kid play more? So having people really just chew on something will help them get those strategic thinking skills revved up and working or learned. And then you could have people, again, on a Padlet or some other anonymous, give them homework. What are some of the current policies, practice programs in the organization that, A, have already been shifted to create greater class access, to dismantle some classist attitudes? So start with strengths. And which of these could still be improved more, and which other ones need to be analyzed? Mm-hmm. So collect up a bunch before you move on to actually practicing in a session.
Yeah, I love that. Even as I think about like the small things, which aren't small for some folks, really small and really big for other folks, or, you know, like the celebration of people and needing to, right, like, you know, I'll donate $5 and we can do the cake or we can do that. Like, how do we balance all of that out in the celebration of people, but also the cost to people? And where is this middle ground space, and what does that look and feel like? Yeah.
So that could be one of the two scenarios that people chew with first, because that one really, and then always looking for other ways, not the best way,
Yeah.
But in that one, could we have a list of tasks and money we need to raise with a barometer? And as people give money, the barometer increases. And then as people sign up for tasks, people know who's doing those. Mm-hmm. And so not everybody shares money. Some people might be willing to stay after clean up for 10 minutes. And some people might want to give $40 as opposed to five. Mm-hmm. Again, not advertising who gives what, but to say, if you can give more, that might support people. But to say that out loud, get people to practice, and then choose ones that might be a little more complex or related to the daily business of work. And I, if people want to email me, I have some handouts with some basic questions. My guess is you do too, Becky, and email Becky for resources of, I assume they could do that. I'm sorry. Was that true?
Yeah, please.
But everything from this current practice, how did it start? What were its intentions then? By class identity, who did it benefit? Were there barriers created? What's the intention now? By class identity, whose needs does it meet? Whose needs doesn't it meet? Are there barriers or obstacles created? What's the negative impact? What else is possible? Those kinds of questions written down and having people chew on, literally practice on 4, 5, 6 practices, can develop the capacity to take this back to their unit and do it in real time.
Yeah, it's the real time piece. And I would say whatever list you're using or whatever, I want to pay attention to jargon.
I have a bunch, I'll bet.
Yeah, right. And so like, let's also pay attention to that in the questions that we ask, because there's so much jargon. As I think about policies, practices, and unwritten rules and norms, clear your jargon up, folks. That's going to be really important in even asking the questions. And that can feel like, oh, it goes counter to our organization or our profession, and our professions and organizations are filled with classed jargon. And so just be really clear on what you're asking, so that as it's across the board, you're taking as much assumption out as possible, so that folks either are like, I don't know what that means, and so I'm going to answer this, or I'm not going to answer it, or I don't feel competent or, you know, valued enough to answer it. So be clear on those pieces.
So good. And whether you're doing this virtually or in person, having people in small groups, take a policy or practice, make sure everybody understands it, work through those de-jargoned questions, and let people have some reflective time, and then share and have somebody in that small group make sure everybody's voices is included, considered, so that their process is dismantling classism as they're also trying to look at policies. They can come back, share what they did, maybe chart out other ways this could be, and then let it sit till the next session. Have people go out and talk to other people, and then maybe come back and say, I got this new idea, especially I talked to the folks who are implementing this policy, who are impacted by it. And so over several sessions, you can literally do some work of revising, analyzing current policies, practices that then you can then share with the people who made them and who are still enforcing them to consider. So it can be a change process.
Mm-hmm. And what I imagine some folks, because I probably am still in spaces for my own self around, but I want this thing, right? Or I want my continued privilege around that. And what does it mean if I don't have that particular office, or my professional development is decreased because we're going to do professional development across positions. And like, you want to be able to reflect and think about what is the stuff that you're holding, so it's not always a no. And so being critical of your no in class space is really important, because it's hard to reframe it in a way of not having something taken away or giving up something. And it is, how do we like create an equitable space around class in this organization? And that means everybody gets time off for professional development, or these particular funds for professional development.
Even the language time off suggests that we're not doing our work. I never heard it till you just said it.
Mm-hmm.
And so anticipate resistance as you do in this training. And it can be something at the group level by saying, why might some people resist some of these innovative shifts? Because you, like you said, you might have people in the session that are like, no, we can't do that. So let them talk in general. Well, people might resist because of this, or this may not be why, and this could cause a problem. And then teach people how to anticipate resistance or why this may not yet be the best solution yet. All right, how can we address that? So, or if you're like, we're out of time, who can we send this unfinished conversation to? Is there a task force? Is there an employee resource group? Is there a cross-sectional new group that can come together to look at policies and practices with a class lens? And you share all of this great data and conversation with them so they can have it too, but also not have to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
You could give folks homework to say, go back in your own unit and do the same thing. Come up with some policies and practices that you've been using for a while and invite everyone you work with to analyze it with a class lens, A, and then B, add these questions to your meetings. Before we talk about this idea much more by class, by hierarchy, by educational status, whose needs are met, whose aren't, how fair is this when we really look at the needs of the whole organization? And you can actually put these on your agenda. Just three questions: whose needs are met by, and fill in the blank, whose aren't, any barriers created, and how could we make this more equitable and fair with a class lens? Okay, four questions.
Yeah, four questions. And here's the other thing. So even as I'm hearing you talk, Kath, I'm also having some reaction. Because one of the things that we've got to figure out how to balance, and I don't know if I have the answer yet. I think I have the answer when I do anti-racism work and race work is like, listen to people of color, right? And you don't need 12 tasks force and it doesn't need to take 12 months, right? Because that is a very middle-class plus way of doing things.
That's good.
Listen to the voices of like working class folks or people with lower positionality, right? Because they've got answers and it doesn't take 6 months to like listen to them. They've got wisdom and answers and follow their direction with some stuff. Because what we do is we can get caught up in the, we need a subcommittee. This is going to be a strategic plan for the next year. And my working class person is like, fuck, I hate that shit. Right. And then my like middle class space is like, I understand like why that is necessary. It doesn't mean that I value it or agree with it, but like in 12 months, people will have buy-in. And it's like, wow, we could have avoided, like we could have done this 2 months ago, as opposed to like in 2 months, as opposed to in 12 months, because we get stuck. Yeah.
So that raises the question. I love all that you're saying. So two thoughts. One is, if you're in a unit or division, what can we implement now that we're really hearing from folks implementing and impacted by this? And are there other questions that we really do want to pull apart a bit more?
Totally.
And then it doesn't have to be a year if you do kind of large group. Can you do an open forum? Can you do open space where people come together for a half day, maybe twice, to really do real work in the moment? Breath the differences in the room, and you collect up all that data. And then the work then is, how do we then operationalize it? So there are ways to do it differently than kind of a top-down, this means kind of task force that works forever. And then the report stands on the shelf. How about unwritten rules? Because it's one thing to have a policy or practices written down. Some of that, it's like the air you breathe, the culture and the climate, the rules we have. Are there ways that you have asked people to identify those and look at it with a class lens and shift them?
Let's see, the unwritten rules. So sometimes the question I ask is around treatment, right? And so what is the treatment like across different positions? And treatment could be voice time in meetings, but also who gets a hello and who doesn't get a hello.
Love it.
Right. Like that, you know, cause that then shows you like who's getting airtime for value and who's not. So it's usually it's around treatment. How do you know the folks that you work with? Like, you know, do you know parts of their story? And again, usually it's these like folks that get airtime that you know a bit of their story. So how do you know folks? Ooh, other unwritten rule, unwritten rules or norms. I mean, you can go to the who gets an hour and a half lunch and who doesn't. Because I want to have a networked meeting and the lunch took an hour and a half, or that's clocked on my, like, that's already scheduled in my schedule. So my administrative assistant who gets a 30 minute lunch then has to navigate my schedule and know that I get an hour and a half lunch, and she or he or they just like put their head down and do their work. Like, how do we talk about those pieces and recognize, oh, this is how it could land on some folks. Maybe I'm going to change that. Maybe I'm not, but I'm at least going to have a conversation about that.
I love working with you because you come from kind of very specifics and I come from kind of conceptual. So what I hear you saying is asking people, what are the shoulds of the organizations? What are the have tos? How do you have to behave, interact, and what aren't you supposed to do? So that could get some organic input. I, of course, make checklists. So if people want to email me, I have, I think, 2.5 pages of rules, FaceTime. You have to be there from 7 to 12. You can't rock the boat. So about 2/3 to 3/4 are what I think are classist-based toxic work environment. And about 1/3 to 1/4 are more effective dismantling classism ways to be. And so the culture and the climate. And so whether you do it the way of kind of you're talking about, have people share them and then where are we and how do we need to shift it, or using a worksheet so people go, oh, I hadn't realized how many rules we have. About no open conflict and never question a leader in public. And so some of those rules, to then have people really identify them and then sit with which ones of these actually don't serve us, which ones don't help us meet this vision of a really inclusive, equitable by class, and then what could be different. So not only the written policies, but those unwritten rules. And then how do we coach these in orientation and informal coaching and sponsoring and mentoring? And how do we actually systematize coaching the new set of norms that we want that really meet our goals for dismantling classism?
Yeah, that is, I think about how do we put that up front in the recruiting process? Mm-hmm. And how is that part of the job interview through the onboarding process? And we know that organizations just do a poor job with a DEI lens in almost all three of those spaces.
Yeah.
Right. And then it is, okay, so if we're doing this as an organization to like, that's our commitment. Then we also have this commitment to train the folks that are going to supervise the folks coming in. Or there will be, it will be ugly, right? It'll be messy more than it should be.
And in performance management, can you imagine if people have to share, here is how I have promoted and reinforced the new culture that dismantles classism in formal policies and practices and unwritten rules. Here's how I am showing up a new way of being a leader, a new way of being an employee and encouraging others.
Mm-hmm. That would be lovely. That.
Yeah. We just have a few minutes and your wonderful question of what we've learned and been impacted. I've done most everything we've talked about, even our new ideas, I have thought about around anti-racism work. But until meeting you and having you really put class up to me much more, and then these sessions with you so far, I just haven't taken what's here and moved it over here with whatever needs to shift. So I want to personally thank you, for I am much better positioned to design, facilitate, co-lead with someone whose life experiences are much more than marginalized experience, work on classism because what I've learned with you and insights we've gotten together.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you. You know, I have learned from guests that, but like, there is just wisdom that ask the question, put it on an agenda, do a training to introduce like concepts. There are folks and organizations that are just so eager and afraid to talk about class and the ways that it shows up from them individually, but how they're treated or how they treat folks, or that we can't talk about it. And all of our guests have come with this like brilliance. And I think all of us have that brilliance in it. We just got to be able to tap into that. I've learned from you, you know, you're this big macro thinker. And so I always appreciate the systems analysis that you have, especially as I think about class and how to do those various activities and collect some data and get some voices and not try to take it all on at once. Yes, because that will stop us.
Whew. As we close today, we're going to have several more guests. We have several more of these where we're going to invite people in. And so if you have more questions, you can write, you know, get on the website for the radio show, or you can find our emails on our different websites and send us a note if you want us to continue in the last few that we have like this. And we really hope you try out some of these activities with yourself, a group of friends, a few colleagues, maybe in the work environment, and just keep deepening your capacity to be honest, authentic, and see the truth and reality about classism in your organization and society.
Yeah, and good luck doing it. And no, it is, no, it's not like, it is a little scary, and just like lean into that and let it show itself. Just continue to unearth. That's what I say.
Yeah. And in these last 20 days before the midterms, analyze with a class lens as you choose who you are voting for the goodness of the full country, please. And get people you know and love to do the same. Doctors Becky Martinez and Kathy Hebert, Center for Information Transformation Radio, we cannot wait to bring in some more guests and continue this dialogue. Thank you all for joining us.
You've been listening to Dr. Kathy Hebert on Transformation Talk Radio. Thanks for tuning in, and be sure to catch us next time as Kathy inspires listeners to become agents of change, motivate, innovate, and speak truth to power. Step into the courageous you that will change the world. Connect to life-changing conversations to extend your reach. For more information on Kathy and her work, please visit drkathyhebert.com. That's drkathyhebert.com.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.